It's the Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980, always live as well on the free Odyssey app, streaming live on YouTube too, at the Team 980. Just after 5 o'clock on this Thursday, means 5:30 on Thursday. That's when you never read the comments coming up, but it's time for Not My Beat.
Today's top story, from the perspective of someone who's there.
You are looking live.
This just in.
Not My Beat.
Top story, game one of the Eastern Conference Finals, a classic last night. Tim Bontemps was there for ESPN. Tim, what's up, dude? How are you?
Doing good, Craig. How are you, man?
I'm great. Great to have you back. And I got to start by asking you, where did you take in the final 3 minutes in overtime? Because I was listening to a Zach Lowe's pod, and you had Chris Mannix on. And Mannix said that a lot of folks, and Zach said, a lot of folks abandoned ship with somewhere between 3 minutes and a minute to go, went down to the media room. Apparently getting around MSG is real hard from the media seats. Did you get to see the end in the arena, or were you with Mannix and everybody else in the media room going, oh my God, this is happening?
No, I didn't leave my seat. It
there
is a pain to get around MSG, but it's not that much of a pain. So I was in my seat till the end of the game. I never leave my seat until the starters are out of the game, if I ever do, and anywhere. And I was in my seat and saw something that I would like to say was totally unbelievable, except the Pacers have made it kind of believable the way they've done it over and over again over the past few weeks in these playoffs.
So the classic sports talk question or sports TV questions, like, did the Knicks choke? Is this on the Pacers? Do we give them credit? But if we take a rational approach to those questions, what are the things that the Pacers did right to make this comeback happen, and where could the Knicks have prevented it?
Yeah, I was going to say, to have something like this happen, Craig, it's all the above, right? There were some bad calls by the refs both ways throughout the game. That certainly played a part in this. The Knicks had some disastrous things happen in the final few minutes in overtime. Obviously, the three missed free throws from OG Anunoby and Karl Towns were critical. Some very careless turnovers, flinging the ball all over the place, early calling of timeouts, leaving them without any timeouts. It's been a very consistent theme of these Pacers comebacks, right? You have teams calling these timeouts before they try to inbound the ball, burning them early, and then they don't have them late, and they can't get the ball in, and they throw a crazy pass. And then Indiana, look, I mean, obviously Aaron Nesmith was 7-for-8 from three in the game in regulation and was insane in the fourth quarter. The Pacers couldn't miss down the stretch. Their relentless pace and energy throughout the game is draining on opponents. We've seen this happen time and again. And look, they also just got lucky, right? Like, they got lucky on, I think you could argue that they had two 50-50 calls on these challenges that both broke in their favor. They obviously couldn't miss a shot. The Knicks, Karl Towns, one of the best shooters in the league, he misses two free throws. Like, all of these things had to happen to have the Pacers have a chance to win. And that's before you even get to the crazy Halliburton shot that, you know, popped up in the air like Don Nelson shot, you know, 50-some years ago for the Celtics and finally fell through the basket, right? Like, all these things together were required to have this thing come off the way it did. And it's also why, despite the fact the Knicks are down 0-1 in the series, as long as they come back and win game two, which I expect them to tomorrow night, I actually came away from that game overall feel pretty good about where the Knicks are at, because there were a lot of good things that happened for them to build that 15-point lead or 17-point lead they had in the fourth quarter. And I think that's probably the bigger takeaway for me from the game than the Pacers pulling off a frenetic comeback in terms of where the series should be able to go from here.
Tim Bontemps, ESPN NBA reporter with us here on the Hoffman Show. A lot to unpack there. I want to start with the timeouts and the Thibodeau part of this, because not only are the Knicks burning timeouts before being able to get the ball inbounds, Tibbs uses a challenge very early in this game. And we've seen this now, multiple coaches in these playoffs be stuck late, unable to challenge calls, where you see Carlisle save. There's a couple opportunities potentially for him to challenge stuff earlier throughout the game. He saves him for late. He has a huge one with 30 seconds to go, and then another one with 20 seconds to go in overtime. As you talk to folks around the league, Tim, is that something where coaches are just like, I gotta ignore my players early. I gotta ignore my own instincts early and save it no matter what? Or is there any like, is there merit to an early challenge if it's not poorly spent? Because I think that's the other part of the Tibbs thing yesterday is, like, it was a bad challenge. That call was never getting overturned. But
yes.
strategically, like, what's the bigger issue? The miss on the likelihood of getting it right or the overall strategy of just you got to eat it early and save it for the end?
I mean, it's not really a question you can answer like that, right? Because a lot of it comes down to the value add of the challenge, right? Like, if it's the first quarter and you're guaranteed to get a possession because, like, they missed, let's just say it's Aaron Nesmith. Aaron Nesmith hits the ball out of bounds, like, throws the ball out of bounds with his hand. They give it to the Knicks or give it to the Pacers, right? Some would argue, I think fairly, that if you are guaranteeing yourself an extra possession in the game, I mean, look, that became a one-possession game last night, right? If you guarantee Sure. yourself an extra possession and you score, that could be the thing that wins you a game. Obviously, if you're taking points off the board, for sure, or putting points on the board, for sure, there's also a lot of merit in challenging earlier in the game. If it's like you feel extremely confident you're going to win, and it's either going to be erasing a three-shot foul or picking up a two- or three-shot foul. Again, if you're putting points on or off the board, I think most, you know, analytically from whether you should use it or not, most people would say it's probably good to use it. I think you're right, Carlisle waiting. It certainly paid off for him last night. He won a couple of 50-50 calls that both of them, I thought, were fine for Indiana to win, but certainly would have been fine if the Knicks won them. I think the bigger issue was that what you cannot do in the playoffs is burn a challenge on a play you're not going to get overturned. And for the vast majority of the time, if there's contact by two players and you're asking the official to say they're wrong, they're not going to say they're wrong. Because in a lot of ways, like, just truthfully, they're not wrong, right? Like, yeah. On that play, Jalen Brunson got into it with Aaron Nesmith. You easily could have called a foul on Aaron Nesmith, but Jalen Brunson was pushing off him also. So there's not really a reason for them to change that call. And there wasn't enough of a value add there for the Knicks to me to do it, especially because 2 minutes later, because the argument immediately is, well, it's Jalen Brunson's third foul. Well, five possessions later, maybe Clarice Halliburton comes down, kicks his leg out, clearly kicks Jalen Brunson, shoots the ball, gets Jalen Brunson called for his fourth foul. And if the Knicks had challenged that one, they automatically would have overturned it. Right? Because you kick your leg out, you create contact. That's an offensive foul on Tyrese Halliburton. And then maybe Jalen Brunson doesn't have five fouls in the fourth quarter and overtime of this game. And maybe Jalen Brunson isn't playing Matador defense, trying not to foul out of the game in the fourth quarter and overtime of this game. Right? So, again, that's where, to me, it's less about the specifics of should you just never challenge at all and wait for the final 30 seconds. But what you can't do is have a bad one and burn a timeout and lose the ability to do it again. Because that's where they come back to haunt you. And I certainly think it came back to haunt the Knicks last night.
Tim Bontemps, ESPN, with us here on The Hoffman Show, talking about game one of the Eastern Conference Finals. So to circle back to your larger point, Tim, you come out of this game encouraged by the Knicks because they were up by that six, like, in order to blow a 16-point lead or a 14-point lead mm-hmm. or a 9-point lead, you got to be up by that with those times to go. Why, like, I guess if I'm going to counter you, right, just for play devil's advocate, It's a 48-minute game. We know the Pacers wear teams down. And we saw even in the Knicks-Celtics series, like the Celtics had multiple leads. The Knicks came back and were like, they can't possibly do this again. And they kept doing it again and again. Why do you think the Knicks have the fortitude here to survive what will probably be a final push in all of these games by the Pacers? Because that's how the Pacers are built.
Well, the Knicks are a very mentally tough team, and they've been great in the clutch all year. I mean, they have the clutch player of the year on their team in Jalen Brunson, right? So I'm not going to say, well, the Knicks just don't know how to play in the clutch anymore because they had one disastrous game against a team that's been very good at doing this over and over again, right? The other thing I would say is that if you look at the last 2 minute report just came out for this game, which I'm sure is going to be a doozy.
Yeah, I'm sure it's long as well. And put the goaltend and overtime on there and all that.
I would suspect it is quite long. But if you to me, I came into the series with a few major pivot points to really watch in terms of how this was going to go, right? One was, are the Pacers going to be able to stop Jalen Brunson? The only person who stopped Jalen Brunson in game one were the referees, right? The Pacers had no prayer of stopping Jalen Brunson. Aaron Nesmith and Andrew Nembhard are terrific players. defensively, they could not guard Jalen Brunson. I don't really see any way that's going to change. The Pacers don't have different players they could put on them. Brunson's very comfortable against those guys. He was awesome against them last year in the playoffs. I think if he's healthy, he's going to put up big numbers in the series. Karl Towns versus Miles Turner. Karl Towns destroyed Miles Turner. Miles Turner was not even a factor in the game. Thomas Bryant was in the game in the fourth quarter. Miles Turner wasn't playing. So Miles Turner can hit shots. He's had a really good playoffs. But I think that's a very good matchup for Karl Towns. He was great in game one. Yes, I know he missed the free throws late. But he, I think, is going to get open, clean looks from the perimeter. I think that matchup, there's a lot of reason to think the Knicks continue to win that. And then Mitchell Robinson came in off the bench and absolutely destroyed Indiana on the boards, just like he did against Boston in the first round, and was wreaking havoc with them the entire game. And they have, again, the Pacers don't have any size. They have nobody to contend with Mitchell Robinson inside. So, again, yes, the Pacers can hit a ton of shots. Yes, they play a frenetic pace. But, again, do I think Aaron Nesmith is going 7-for-8 from three every game and hitting 6 threes in the fourth quarter, which no one had ever done in the history of the league before? No, I don't think it's going to happen 4 out of 7 times. So, yes, Indiana could definitely win the series. I thought it was going to be Knicks in 7. Certainly blowing a game like this at home is a devastating thing to do. But I expect the series is going to be 2-2 after 4. And I think overall, if you come out of this, I think if you're a Knicks fan or if you're the Knicks organization, you can point to a lot of things and say these things that were sort of key things to watch coming into the series all look pretty comfortably in New York's favor after the first game. And there's not a lot of things I'd point to for Indiana and say there's a reason why it should be different. And that's why I would say that it should carry over. But your devil's advocate point about the Boston series is exactly right, because that was the weirdest series I've ever covered. And the Knicks were down by 15 or more in the first 5 games, and they won 3 of them. Yeah. So, you know, like, who knows with the way these playoffs have gone, how this thing is going to go over the next couple of weeks.
And we see weird stuff happen. I mean, you know, the 3-1 year where Golden State blows the finals lead.
Yeah.
This is the same year they were up 3 or down 3-1 against Oklahoma City. So, like, the ping pong nature of it all is bizarre sometimes in the NBA playoffs, actually often in the NBA playoffs. Which leads to my last question for you, Tim. Tim Bontemps, ESPN, with us. So, I felt last night watching on TV, and you will have a much better sense, one, having covered multiple conference finals over your career, and two, having been in the building. But watching on TV, I had this sense of like, oh, these two teams are comfortable. Like, they know each other. They played each other in the playoffs. There's all this history. And unlike a lot of times in conference finals, when you have teams that haven't been there before, there wasn't the nervous energy I sensed it going through that game one. Eventually, the reality that this is the conference finals is going to hit. And there's going to be a crank of, like, the screws are going to get tightened. When that happens, are you more confident in one side or the other? And also, you know, is the premise of that is the premise of that correct in that question?
I don't know. I mean,
felt different.
I just don't really. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think at this point in the season, I don't really think that's the case. And you've got, on all these teams, you've got guys who have, you know, between Anthony Edwards and Jalen Brunson and Tyrese Haliburton and Chigo Saksa, I mean, any of these teams at the end of the season, you've got guys that can step up and make massive plays in big spots, right? And I don't think – you don't make it to the conference finals by accident. So, yeah, I don't – I think it's just –
I guess I just look at teams like, you know, when Memphis played Golden State or even Boston a couple years ago in the finals against Golden State. And there just seemed to be a know-how for those Warriors teams, for some of the teams that have that championship pedigree. And because these teams have never played in the finals, and neither of them have, where it's not a team that's been there versus a team that hasn't, it does, to me, the tenor of it felt a little bit different last night. But also, I'm watching it on TV, you're there, and you've also covered these things in person.
I don't think, I mean, I understand where you're coming from, and I think it's a reasonable question, but no, I don't think, I didn't feel that in the game. And like, look, I mean, again, if the reason this is interesting to me is that the Pacers have now done this exact same thing 3 times in 3 series, and it basically had never happened before besides that.
Yeah.
So how in the world do they keep doing it? Like, I think that is fascinating. But no, I didn't think that, like, the Knicks got in the moment and, like, melted down. You know? Like, I just think the Pacers did a bunch of crazy things in a good way in a row, and the Knicks did a bunch of crazy bad things in a row. And, you know, like, yes, the Warriors found a way to win games like that. The Warriors are also a dynastic team, right? Like, you can always go back and look at dynastic teams and say, oh, yeah, the Jordan Bulls or the Kobe Shaq Lakers when they came back from down 15 against Portland in that, I think it was game 7 in the first year they won the title, right? Like, you think back on that now, it's like, oh, yeah, of course Kobe and Shaq found a way to come back. But, like, at that point, they hadn't won anything yet, right? Like, they were playing this Portland team with Scottie Pippen and all these vets and were supposed to be great. And, you know, they found a way to win. And, like, it's easy to sort of retrofit that kind of stuff onto teams. But I think with the four teams we've got in the conference finals this year, despite the fact that they don't have finals experience among them, you've got a lot of teams that are very comfortable in late and close situations, have had a lot of success in them. And I just thought it was a great basketball game last night that led to a truly unbelievable ending.
No doubt about it. And you got another, hopefully, great game tomorrow. Tim Bontemps on the scene in New York for ESPN covering the Eastern Conference Finals. Tim, where can people go? Obviously, ESPN.com for anything written. You're doing Winhurst Pod and all that kind of stuff. Where else can people find what you're doing?
Yeah, doing me, Brian, and Tim McMahon are on the Hoop Collective three times a week. Just got done recording the first half of it, the other half of it after tonight's game for tomorrow morning. Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And, writtenwork.com.
Showing up on TV.
Obviously, I'll be on TV. I'll be on TV plenty all day tomorrow ahead of what should be a hell of an atmosphere at the Garden as the Knicks try to even this thing up.
No doubt about it. Tim, appreciate your time, sir. Thank you.
Anytime, Craig. Thanks for having me, man. Talk soon.
Indeed. That's Tim Bontemps with us here on The Hoffman Show. And, Anthony, I'm not totally sure that I did a great job asking that last question because – like, to me, it's not about, like, did that stuff happen last night? It's, like, is the pressure going to crank as the series moves forward? I actually feel like last night felt like just another really intense, good basketball game between two teams with elevated stakes. But it's not like the, oh, this is the Eastern Conference Finals and a trip to the NBA Finals is on the line yet. But, and I don't know whether that I asked that by the very well by the way that Tim answered it. But... I'm definitely curious to see, because I do think it's very easy and very lazy just to be like, oh, the Knicks melted down. The Knicks, how could they possibly have done that? The Knicks blew it. I don't think the Knicks blew it. I think the Knicks made mistakes, but you make mistakes in basketball. It's not a mistake-free game. I credit the Pacers for doing hitting crazy shots and Aaron Nesmith losing his mind more than I do anything else.
Yeah, I mean, also, I just feel like the Pacers, they were there last year. Or was that 2 years ago?
Last year.
Yeah,
because they beat the Knicks to get there.
So I think they understand, you know, the gravity of the moment. And then with the Knicks, it's more so like, I think they're led and spearheaded by Jalen Brunson, and he's been in so many winning moments. Like, he's won at every level of his career except the NBA level. So I think, you know, this is just another situation where he just doesn't flinch. And I think, you know, the rest of the Knicks rally around him. So, again, like, things didn't go their way down the stretch of the game, but I think they're going to be able to bounce back. I would not be surprised if they go out there and just dominate the Pacers tomorrow. Like, I think that's what kind of – just because they realized, like, they really let one get away.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, there are guys with championship experience on these teams. And while it's not a ton and these teams haven't been through these moments together, the Knicks have OG Anunoby, who won with the Raptors. His teammate was Pascal Siakam. On the Thunder, they have another one of the Raptors. Who do they have? Blanken. They've got someone who's won one, I'm pretty sure. And then the Timberwolves have someone as well, and I'm blanking on who it is. But, like, there are some guys who have been, like, someone else was a role player on, the, I think, the Bucks championship team that's on one of these teams, and my brain scrambled right now, and I'm only thinking of the two
Caruso's
guys.
Caruso's won one.
Yeah, Caruso with the Lakers. There's the Oklahoma City guy, and Minnesota's got someone. So there are players that have won championships on these teams, but these teams have not been through that experience together. And so as things get tight, and as you have to make adjustments and, like, do playoff things, how do these teams handle it? You know, not just from, like, a pressure, do they melt mentally standpoint, But like, how do they execute? Because that's feeling pressure too. Is like, how do you execute in the biggest moments? Can you keep calm and do the things you got to do? When you're Carl Towns and you've hit 90% of your free throws in the playoffs, missing too late, these things happen. But if they happen multiple times, what do we say? Once is a coincidence, twice is a something else, three times is a trend.
Yep.
Well, I was hoping you'd fix the analogy. Two.
Once is a fluke, twice is a coincidence.
There we
three
go.
Three times is a trend.
That's what we're looking for.
Or not make it a standard.
Yeah, well, we'll see how game two goes in just a few days. Actually, tomorrow. And Bon Temps will be there. Thanks again to Tim for joining us. When we get back, comment section time. It's never read the comments here on the Hoffman Show. Anthony, we might have a problem. You're not even going to say what? It works better on the radio when you respond to me audibly instead of just staring at me.
What happened, Craig?
What has happened far too often in the history of our show during Never Read the Comments?
We get dumb comments?
No, I mean, that is technically correct, although not the answer we are looking for. What specifically happens to me often during this segment?
You forget to pull comments.
No. I mean, I actually feel like I'm pretty good about that. I've got the comments ready. Hint.
Oh, you have no water.
I wind up like choking. For some reason, this is the point in the week where my voice runs out and then I have no water. And because I was pulling comments, I didn't refill my water. So we're emptying Never Read the Comments with an empty water bottle.
Would you like me to assist you?
No, I mean, I feel like it's safer if you are here doing, I mean, I don't know, what's better? You running and filling up my water bottle, or you being here to bail me out in case the voice goes boom?
I mean, it'll only take me about 2 minutes.
If it takes you that long, like, you don't need to, this is a big water bottle. You don't need to fill it up all the way.
Yeah.
All right. I guess you should hit the button, bring the bed down, and then hopefully I can get through the first, like, 2 minutes on my own.
We tried to warn them. They didn't listen.
Yeah!
Every week, the Hoffman Show goes into the belly of the beast.
We read those comments, baby.
Never read the comments.
All right, here we go. We will dive in as Anthony makes his way over here to get my water bottle just in case my voice decides to die during this segment. And that'll be that. So we do a radio show every single day. You're listening to it right now. You're watching it right now. It starts at 4 o'clock. It ends at 7. And this time of year, it actually genuinely ends. Thank you, Anthony. There's my water bottle. It genuinely ends at 7 o'clock during basketball season. It ends at random times because we have games on. But we take the show. We chop it up into the segments. We post them on the internet, and you all react to them. And then we read those comments, and that is this segment. It's called Never Read the Comments because we believe in irony. Okay, we had plenty of funny ones this week. I'm gonna dive into some of the content, though, here. And one of the big things that we obviously discussed this week was the tush push and the debate around it. Ultimately, we know by now here on Thursday that the tush push had survived at the very least another year, if not into the future, where they are going to keep it in. It's a football play that's allowed in the NFL, despite the fact that the league and 22 teams wanted it gone. 24 was the votes needed. And a lot of it goes around this central idea that, like, is this a football play? And J.W. Carroll, 6378, says, for those who say it's not a football play, I wonder if they can define what is a football play. So this, to me, is actually at the crux of it, because until someone gets hurt, which could happen for sure, there is no data currently to support that there's an elevated injury risk. And not only has there not been any injuries, but I do wonder if there's ever been any kind of extra data where, like, oh, the pounds of pressure is different than a normal pile, or we think this particular thing is a risk. There's literally nothing on the injury side of it that suggests that there is some kind of elevated risk. So if that's the case, and you're actually making this argument that it's a football play, one, wow, that was fast, Anthony. And the water bottle is completely full. Thank you, sir. You're look, Anthony Haney, everybody, here on my side of the screen. you Go back to your box now. You go over there. Thank you. Okay, so you get parched. What a mensch. The point is, if you're going to call it a rugby play, you're wrong. Because it's not a rugby play. I love how Anthony sits down. The first thing he does is have a sip of water. It's not a rugby play. You've never watched rugby. You've never played rugby. You never asked rugby people. So that's thing one. Thing two, to me, the reason it's quote-unquote not a football play, if you're going to make that argument, is in football, you don't push the guy with the ball. You block for the guy with the ball. And then he is trying to get into open space and run away from the other guys trying to tackle him or take his flag if you're doing flag football. You are not ever pushing the guy with the ball as strategy outside of this one thing. And so if you wanted to say, in the spirit of the game, this is not a football play because we don't push ball carriers and outlaw it, that's fine. I'm down with that. You also then need to outlaw doing it in the middle of the field. And that becomes its own thing because the defense, you know, they wall up and try to push and you got the whole thing. So I think part of the reason this doesn't pass is because that's not made clear. Like, how is it not a football play? And because there's not a good answer to that, I think that's a big reason, Anthony, why it ultimately stayed.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, the only real, because it doesn't pose like health concerns either. Like, they've done, you know, studies on that as well. Like, no one is getting like injured on these plays. I think one thing to point out, though, it is tough to officiate because if you recall, you know, when the Commanders played the Eagles, Juergens was sort of kind of offsides. Deron Payne's hand was underneath the ball. Sure. Like,
so technically, how much harder is it than any other play? Like the offsides, the spotting of the ball, we saw that in the AFC Championship game where I feel like they got it wrong. Like, is it that much harder by anything, like especially compared to a regular quarterback sneak, right? Because you're not going to outlaw quarterback sneaks. So what is it about the tush push that makes it different than a quarterback sneak that you could outlaw? It's just the pushing from behind. Because if you know quarterback sneak is, let's say they outlawed it, right? First, fourth, and one of the season, Eagles line up in still a big old Haas package, and it's quarterback sneak. Deron Payne, or whoever they're playing week one, that defensive tackle is going to be right there. So at that point, what that difficulty in legislating it, the difficulty of everything, it doesn't change. And that, to me, is part of the reason why it stays, is you're just picking on the push. And if you can't find a good reason why the push makes it worse or more unsafe or not football, then you don't really have an argument.
I think one last thing that's funny about the tush push.
Is this called the tush push?
It's been legal since 2005. Like, people could have been doing this. Like, and it's just the fact that, you know, the Eagles in 2022 decided to, you know, put into a their offense, like,
yep,
now we want to complain about it, like
100%. And you know, you have some people like Farbod 21 says pushing and pulling the ball carrier should be banned anywhere. It was stupid to change the rule and allow it, but again, it went 17 years before anybody did anything about it. I'd pick this one, I'm not gonna lie, Anthony, because I think the screen name is hilarious. Your ex grandpappy says extremely annoying.
That's actually funny.
Your ex grandpappy, But then you have C-Guy2Guy, 5'11". I just read them. It's a copycat league. Everybody's doing it or going to start doing it, even if they don't have a quarterback that can do it. Get your tight end or somebody else to do it. Get a big fat guy behind him to push. And that's the thing, is other teams could have been doing this too. And in that way, it's not unfair that the Eagles do this and nobody else does. Everybody else could do it, except for they don't. They don't because it's a personnel and coaching-driven success. Personnel of their O-line is great, and Jalen Hurts is a monster. His leg drive is better than every other quarterback because if there was a quarterback squat competition, he'd win it. Josh Allen might come in second, which is why the Bills are really good at it, but other teams don't want to do it. And there have been other teams, like the Chiefs, I believe, have done a version where Kelsey goes under center or Noah Gray goes under center. The Commanders a couple years ago when Logan Thomas was here, he did it. And in fact, I think didn't the Commanders try it this past year? They either motioned Mariota in or they did something.
It was Mariota.
Yeah, and they fumbled the snap or whatever. And yep. It didn't work. So, like, other teams have tried it, but the Eagles, it's hard to practice. You're not doing full contact tush pushes, but, like, there are technique type of things and timing and whatever that they practice and they dedicate the resources and the time. And by resources, I mean the time to meeting time, practice time, and other teams can make those same decisions. They don't. And so they don't get the results. And also when Jalen Hurts is not there, I guarantee you it's not going to work as well.
Yeah. Didn't Kenny Pickett run it? I think they ran it against us.
Did it work?
I think it did, but it wasn't the same kind of push.
Yeah, like, would it work the same percent if it was Kenny Pickett all the time?
No chance.
And that's the thing. Is, like, it's... If LeBron James was an NFL wide receiver and the fade became a 92% proposition, you think they'd outlaw fades?
No.
That's kind of what's happened.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, we got a unicorn player doing unicorn stuff in Jalen Hurts, and credit to the Eagles. That hurts to say, but credit to the Eagles. Next topic in Never Read the Comments. We did our reaction to some of the ESPN rankings, and the one that got the most attention, Anthony, wasn't the one that we talked about. It was one that we mentioned in passing. Escaped 1534 says, I don't see a big drop-off in Jaden Daniels because his offensive line will be better, which means a more stable pocket and a better running game. Plus, they've added maybe three Samuels, Lane, Merritt, more weapons. The running game must improve. I can't see the defense being 31st in the league! ! And the defense part is the one that got a lot of attention, so we're going to come back to that in a second. I will say one mistake that I think Commanders fans are making is Ja'Cory Kroski-Merritt and Jalen Lane. Like, oh, they're such huge additions. No, they're new. Don't confuse new with shiny, and don't confuse shiny with effective. They're rookies. Is there a chance that they play well? Absolutely. The way Bill runs, that kid is, his highlight reel is fun. But he's a rookie. He was taken in the 7th round. So we really think he's going to come in and be amazing? Would love for this little 10 seconds that I just did to be on Cold Takes Exposed in September, October, November, and December. Would love for him to be a 1,200-yard back as a rookie or something crazy. Would love him to be a 600-yard back as a rookie. Who they figured out midway through the year was like, oh, this guy's better than what we have. Amazing. Love that. Jalen Lane, same thing. What if he's just better than Deebo Samuel? Sick. Deebo's on a one-year deal and moderately expensive. Jalen Lane is a rookie and is going to be cheap for the next 4 years. Awesome. Here for it. Sign me up. I'd love them both to be great, obviously. But I am not going to get out over my skis and count on production from a 4th and a 7th round rookie, because that is how you set yourself up to be disappointed. And there is no reason to do that when there is so many other genuine things to be excited about.
Yeah, I mean, I like what we've done in the draft.
Same. So. That's not meant to say they're going to be bad. It's just, let's be realistic about what we expect from rookies.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, people want... I trust what Adam Peters and company have done, and I think it's just more so fans just got to be patient and, you know, just be willing to, you know, trust the process kind of thing.
Yeah, which brings us to the defense. BRSYSYRI, Bryce Isserion, I think is what that's, or is it Bryce? No. This guy, 4516, says 31st defense has to be one of the worst takes ever. We're not great, but we are between average and good at worst. Cole Callaway, 6'9", 58, projected 31st ranked defense is laughable. On paper, our defense has massively improved in pass defense with our upgraded corner room, and our run defense has also improved with a beefier D-line in depth. Pass rush is our only setback, in my opinion. So this is in reaction to Mike Clay's rankings from ESPN.com. They do them every year, fantasy rankings. And I agree that that is feels wrong. 31st. I just want to put that out there before I say what I'm about to say, which is, why would someone as smart as Mike Clay say that? Right? It's a projection. It's also very fantasy skewed. So if I start to think about it, I'm like, okay, why would they come out there in the projection? And is that a cause for concern? If I'm going to put my journalism hat on and try to see all angles, not have anything surprise me, why would the Commanders defense all of a sudden, we're in December and we're like, yo, this is bad. And there's a couple things that come to mind. I think first and foremost, Anthony, is the schedule. Think of the quarterbacks they have to play this year. Like, they have week one, probably Russell Wilson, whatever. Week two, Jordan Love. Week three, Geno Smith. Week four, Michael Penix. We'll see how he is by week four. Week five, Justin Herbert. Week six, Caleb Williams. Wild card, but that's a Ben Johnson offense. Week seven, Dak. Week eight, Mahomes. Week nine, Darnold. Week 10, Goff and the Lions. Week 11, Tua and the Dolphins. Week 12, 13 is Bo Nix and a Broncos offense. That's Sean Payton, and now he's in year two. Week 14, we'll see what J.J. McCarthy is, but it's the Vikings offense. Giants again in 15, and then Eagles, Cowboys, Eagles. So you're either facing really explosive playmakers and really good coaches. That's the Giants. They've got Malik Nabers, and Brian Daboll's a good offensive coach. One of the best 13 quarterbacks in the league or so. Wherever you have a Love, Penix, I guess Penix is kind of the exception, but even their pass catching unit and you know their running back in Bijan is sick. Like the Chargers, you got Herbert. The Bears, we'll see what they are with Ben Johnson. Like every single week, you're like, I could see why that's a good offense. Right? Even the Giants, Malik Nabers with Jameis Winston or Russell Wilson, like that's potential potency. I don't think they're going to be good week over week, but you catch them on the wrong week and like that's dangerous. I don't want to deal with that. So I could see if I'm playing devil's advocate, I can see a world where this defense is bad. Because the other part of it is like, okay, well, let's look at the Commander side of the equation. Is Marshawn Lattimore just going to turn it around? Upgraded corner room. Oh, really? Like, who honestly played worse last year? And this is going to get me killed in the comments. Who was really worse, Benjamin St. Juice or Marshawn Lattimore?
Benjamin St. Juice.
You think he was worse than Lattimore?
Lattimore had bad games against A.J. Brown. Like,
he had bad Brown games against A.J. Brown. Problems. He had bad games against Mike. He only played like five games, and three of them were really bad.
I mean, the Saints, he shut his side of the field down. He played the Lions.
He was facing Jake Haener.
I'm just saying. Like, still, he didn't get any targets. And then also, when we played the Lions, he didn't give up much either. So,
sure. And like,
it's a small sample size, but
Juice had a couple good games in there.
I can't get over Juice letting Mike Williams slow ass run right by. I can't get over that.
I am not telling you that Juice was good. I'm telling you the higher percentage of plays last year played in a Commander's uniform, I would bet that if I did play for play, green dot, red dot, Juice had more good plays. Because, I mean, Juice had just these catastrophic mistakes. But, like, the games against the Eagles, man, were like every play, it felt like Lattimore was giving up penalties, holding, doing stuff. And like, I don't know. It wasn't good. And
I mean, AJ now, had his turn with Benjamin St. Juice 2 years ago and Emmanuel Forbes. So we knew not to go that route.
To be very clear, I think Marshawn Lattimore is a better player than Benjamin St. Juice. And I would bet on him for this year. And Lattimore was banged up. He came way mid through the year. But like, the point is like the upgrade wasn't. You're counting on a guy who was it. Let's say Lattimore was better. Like you agree, though, it's like way closer than it should be.
Yeah.
So let's say Lattimore was better than Juice last year. Because I can make that argument too.
You're right.
Right. And maybe I should have made that argument because now people are already screaming at me. But like it was way closer than it should have been. And if that's the case, they didn't really upgrade their corner room in the way they need to unless Trey Amos is awesome. Well, Trey Amos is a rookie. So, like, is he going to come in and be awesome from day one?
Yeah, he got to prove it.
And Sanders Stills now going to the slot. Like, I liked Mikey last year. One, I don't think it was quite as good as some fans thought because he was, like, the expectations versus performance, he was great. But if you're just doing raw performance, there was a lot of room to improve for Mike Sanders still. And he now is going to shift inside. And that, in some ways, is a harder position than playing outside and some of the stuff you deal with in the nickel. We'll see with the, you know, I like Will Harris. Is he as good as Jeremy Chinn? Probably not. How big is that drop off? And then, you know, God forbid Wagner finally falls off the age cliff. Again, knock on all the, like, there's a way. I think ultimately this defense is going to be better than last year because I think they have made major upgrades in the run game up front, first and second down defense. And that has a trickle down effect where everything else becomes easier. You get in more third and longs. You're not in third and shorts. You don't get in second and short, which is where a lot of teams take explosive shots. Because if you're in second and 10 or second and 8, you're just trying to get to third and short. And so there is a ton of pass rush opportunities that comes from that. There's just a system-wide upgrade that should cause better performance on the defensive side. I firmly believe that is truth. But if you're going to make the devil's advocate argument to say, okay, why would someone who puts in as much work as Mike Clay come out and say the Commanders are the 31st defense in his projections? I think it's part the secondary could fall apart, and there's other pieces. You don't have a stud pass rusher, whatever. And the schedule and the quarterbacks and the offenses you play are really good. And to think that it's impossible, I think, is a level of arrogance I'm not comfortable with yet. So, again, do I think it's going to happen? No. But that would be the reason why if you don't want to have burgundy and gold colored glasses on.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be that bad.
I don't think so either. Again, I agree with most of the comments where they're like, I don't think we're going to be great, but we're not going to be bad. All right, last but not least, we talked about the latest Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese incident. Chanel Jones, 1091, says, let them have a rivalry. It's great for the game. This is as close to Magic versus Bird that we have in the WNBA. I never said you couldn't have a rivalry. What I did say is you don't need idiocy to have a rivalry. It wasn't the play or the intensity that, or people getting excited about the matchup even. It's when there's a perfectly normal flagrant foul that happens in the course of many basketball games. It doesn't need to be blown up into a national security issue on Sports Talk Television. And that's what happened. And that's the part that I hate. And we don't need any of that. And by the way, Angel Reese has got to become a better basketball player if they're going to have a real rivalry here, because while Angel is like an all-star, if you're going to have Magic versus Bird, they were the two best players in the game. If you want that, you're looking more at Asia Wilson versus Caitlin Clark, the way Asia is right now and the ascension that Caitlin's on, because those, you know, if Caitlin can get past Nafisa Collier and Brianna Stewart, then now we're talking about the two best players in the game, but Angel's not on that level yet, which is fine. She was a rookie last year, and she was the seventh pick. And there's a lot of seventh picks from the last 5 years that aren't even in the league anymore, because that's how hard that league is. And then last but not least, Anthony, Randy Silva-J8M says, there's too many idiots and not enough villages, dude.
I'm crying.
Because I talked about how it seems like anytime these two play, a couple of villages seem to be missing their idiot. Too many villages, or too many idiots, not enough villages. So we just got villageless idiots wandering around. And then somehow they walk onto the first take set.
With that too.
All right, when we get back, top story of the day in DC, I guess, is Terry McLaurin missed a practice. Is this a big deal? I think by my tone of voice, you could probably tell where my answer is, but we'll talk about it next on The Hoffman Show.